Welcome to the Max Finance Podcast, where a certified financial planner and personal finance geek discuss how to make intentional financial decisions that maximize your money and achieve your goals. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Max Finance Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking, we're going to be continuing our FIRE mini series, where we go a little bit more in depth, talking through some of the more mechanical pieces, trying to define how do you set that goal initially? How do you know how much you should have in pursuit of retiring early? And what are some different levers that you can think about on that journey? It's surprising. Depending on withdrawal amounts and length of time and living expenses, of course, and all of these different elements, how much that can impact things. So with that being said, let's dive right in. So talking initially about how to frame the number, Lauren, talk to me a little bit more about how you see that. Where do you start first?
Yeah, so I think on the last episode, we touched on the 4% rule and how that is a very, very rough rule of thumb with some caveats that I think we'll kind of dive into a little bit here. But what the 4% rule means is that you can withdraw 4% of your portfolio each year in perpetuity. Now, again, there's caveats there, but it gives you sort of an idea of what the goal is. So the goal would be then 25 times sort of your annual expenses. So let's say your annual expenses is $40,000 a year. That means if you had $1 million, that would be enough to support you during retirement and allow you to withdraw $40,000 each year. And that is inflation adjusted. So as inflation goes up and down, you can always withdraw $40,000, even if your portfolio increases or decreases quite a bit, you can always withdraw $40,000 inflation adjusted each year. So that's kind of a starting point to just get your head kind of around the concept, get a really rough ballpark. And I think it's a good place to start for many people. But yeah, maybe we should talk about where that 4% rule came from and what are some of the kind of conditions or environment that was developed in.
Yeah, great point. So out the gate, the Trinity Study, which is one of the seminal works in retirement planning, has set out to try to answer what was the quote unquote safe withdrawal amount in order to pull from a portfolio looking back in time. So they went back in history. I want to say it's probably like going back to the data set of like 1926, and obviously life looks very different, but there's market data that we're able to draw upon. But going through some of the world's worst times in the market, the Great Depression, and then you've got all of the wars, you've got hyperinflation, you've got, kind of more recently, actually, even before this study was done in the early, I would say mid-90s. So I don't think the tech wreck, the Great Recession, none of that has been factored in. Mm-hmm. But I believe since then that is still the data that was found from that, which again was that 4%, saying that throughout all of those times during history, 4% was that safe withdrawal amount that you could draw from portfolio. And the kicker there is without touching principal. So that's a pretty, meaning if you had $1 million, you could draw the 4% and still have $1 million at the end of your life.
So, oh, really? I didn't actually know that. So that, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's a really, in some people's minds, like really safe perspective. And so it could lead to, well, what if I withdraw more and, 5%, 6%. And so, to end with $0. And so I think it also, I mean, obviously we don't know what is going to happen in the future. The other elements I believe you touched on, which is like this was based on age 65 retirement for mm-hmm. 30 years using a 60-40 portfolio, 60% in stocks, 40% in bonds, which is a very standard, typical, or at least since then has been a very standard and typical pre-retirement and retirement portfolio for traditional retirement. But Yeah, like I think that with that as the backdrop, I mean, obviously there's some elements from a when you expand that time horizon of when you're drawing from the portfolio, that puts some pressure obviously on the portfolio to grow.
Yeah, I think that's you kind of touched on how they do this, and I think that's just important to reiterate, is really the only way that these numbers come from is by kind of doing this called backtesting, looking at previous periods of time and seeing what would have happened. That's really our best kind of guess and indicator of what might happen in the future. I mean, obviously it's nothing's a guarantee and things really change, but that's how they come up with these numbers. But like you mentioned, 30 years is what they use for that. And obviously for someone planning to retire, what we think of as early, anybody who is planning for retirement that's longer than 30 years should be aware of that and some of the differences that that causes, I guess. So, you know, typically you would probably need to decrease your withdrawal rate slightly, not probably as much as you might think, but if you wanted to do something like a 40 or 50 year retirement, having a lower withdrawal rate would probably be better to have sort of a similar levels of likelihood of success.
And so using that $40,000 example and kind of bringing this, you know, to giving folks a number, you mentioned multiplying that by 25. Another way to do it, just divide it by 0.04, get you the same number. What are some other withdrawal rates that you've seen, just based on some research that you've done, that could make sense for folks who are pursuing FIRE?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, it really just depends on a few things, right? I think something to think about is with these studies and these numbers, there's sort of there's an assumption that you're never going to have any additional outside income ever again. You're never going to collect on Social Security, and you're going to live entirely off of your portfolio. And for many people, that's probably not going to be the case. Obviously, it's quite hard to, you know, it's a bit tricky to forecast what Social Security will provide, you know, 30 years from now. And I think the likelihood of people not earning any income, especially when they're at a young age, and I think oftentimes, you know, following people who have sort of retired early, they have almost all just picked up something, not just because they needed money, but because they found something that they wanted to do and found some purpose in it, and it happened to earn them money. And so, but anyway, so I think if you know those things are true, then certainly a higher withdrawal rate could be supported. And then I think something else that's important too is, you know, thinking about what your annual expenses are, and how are they going to change over time? Because it's unrealistic, honestly, to think that you're going to have the, you know, $40,000 in annual expenses every single year till your death, right? It's just not possible. And so that's a challenge too, right? Like expenses will go up and go down. You know, I would imagine that for many people who can retire early, like their expenses, yeah, I don't know. It actually depends. It's hard to say, but you know, some expenses relating to work are going to go down, right? You're not going to be commuting anymore. Maybe you'll be making lunch at home rather than buying lunch out. So in that way, in those ways, your expenses might go down, but you may travel a lot more and that might increase your expenses. So, and also, you know, healthcare can be a big issue in the U.S. If you're currently, you know, if your health insurance is provided by your employer and you quit your job, like that is definitely a large expense that you have to consider. And especially if you're not, I guess, 65 or whatever age that you need to be to kind of join, be part of Medicaid.
65.
Which is,
Medicare.
Yeah, Medicare, excuse me. Medicare. So those are some things to think about. But I would say just in terms of like range of like where are we talking about the ballpark for withdrawal rate, I would say it's, you know, it seems pretty well accepted that like 3% is like the floor, maybe even a little higher, that like there's no, like you could 3% is you're complete almost completely safe. There's really very, very little chance of that ever failing. You know, I think in some cases you could withdraw maybe up to 5%. So I think, you know, but again, it really just depends on so many factors.
Yeah. So there's a lot there that you mentioned. So if folks were, you know, just maybe the last episode was the first time that they've ever heard of this approach of living life, and they're getting into this, you know, we're talking about withdrawal rates as a big impact. And so there are other elements that you mentioned, which include, well, are there going to be other income streams in retirement? One of the biggest, of course, could be Social Security. One way for folks to, so just kind of give you some, a quick calculator or an example of quick. So Social Security, SSA.gov has what's called a benefit calculator, a quick calculator that you can go in where all you have to do is enter in your birth date and your earnings. And then you also enter in what year you're planning on retiring. And then you hit submit and it'll show you, okay, here's what your benefits could look like in that future year. The assumption, however, is that you're going to be working until that point. So you might have to go in and manually adjust, as an example, the future years of zero earnings. So as example, you can't, you can take it as early as 62, but if you're planning on pursuing FIRE, you're probably going to be retiring much earlier than that. So you'll have to kind of do a manual adjust there. The other thing too is we've seen that the Social Security Trust Fund, depending on some of the estimates that you're looking at, could be depleted. There likely will have to be some sort of change done to it. And so what I would imagine being done to it would be pushing back the full retirement age. Currently it's at 67, maybe pushing that back to something like 70 to be able to gain more dollars available for those who are drawing down. It's a very hard pill to swallow to say some folks who are nearing collecting that will then have a reduction. But who knows? You know, that's I would imagine that's going to be a very difficult for somebody who wants to be reelected. You're probably not going to get that passed if you're cutting benefits for those just about to draw. So, even within that, you can see just that variable alone. Okay, maybe it makes sense to do some sort of adjustment. What I've done with clients in the past is, you know, maybe we cut it to in half, or maybe you only use 2/3, or maybe right. You only use 1/3, depending on what you're most comfortable with. But I do want to mention that is a meaningful amount, even if it is cut in some form of or fraction there. So the other element there is okay. So that starts in, you know, if you're talking about 67 or age 70, that could be, you know, 20 some odd plus years from when you start to draw down. And I think we start to build out this or paint this picture. It can be difficult to put all of these different variables in without having some sort of calculator or some sort of way to kind of aggregate all of these. I mean, you could certainly do it back of the envelope. And what we're saying is, okay, take whatever your spending rate is and divide that by the withdrawal rate, or multiply it by, as you say, the 4% is 25. There's different numbers for like 3 or 5. But yeah, if you just divide it by 0.05, 0.03, that can get you kind of a rough idea of what the portfolio size has to be, and give you an idea of what the target could look like.
Yeah, so there are many, many calculators and tools out there. We talked in previous episodes about just sort of tools to help you kind of project kind of future net worth, and as well as kind of likelihood of success of retiring, that kind of both covers both kind of what we call the accumulation phase of saving money, as well as spending money from that portfolio. But there are other tools that are just really focused on trying to help you understand the likelihood of you being able to live just off your portfolio. And so there's kind of what call like FIRE calculators, which again, don't really focus on the helping you project how much money you'll have in the future based on savings. It'll help you predict the likelihood of a portfolio amount supporting a certain withdrawal rate. And so there's a few out there. One is called FIRE Calc, like calculator.com. And the other one is cfiresim.com. And they're similar in that, you input a starting portfolio amount, like let's say $1 million, and you enter a withdrawal amount of $40,000. And it will tell you like the probability of success. And so it does that by, again, finding all of the, so let's say you do a like a 30-year time period. It looks for, okay, how many 30-year time periods have there been in kind of history of I don't know, the stock market and kind of in records. And it says that, okay, if you, you know, started with this amount at this year, and then you withdrew for, again, whatever, 30, 40, 50 years, it'll say, okay, this portfolio would have succeeded or failed. Failed means you ran out of money before reaching that 40-year time period. And it just keeps doing that at every time period that it can fit within the all the time periods. And it comes up with the probability of success. And so they're really, I think, helpful to, you know, understand how these different variables impact that likelihood of success. And so you'll see that, you know, obviously the withdrawal rate has a really big impact. The higher the withdrawal rate, the lower the likelihood of success, right? Because you're taking more out of the portfolio. And then obviously the length of time has an impact, but maybe not as much as you think. So obviously a little bit longer period of time has a higher likelihood of failure. And so other things that are a thing that you can play around with are the asset allocation. So what percentage of stocks and bonds, and you can kind of see how that affects things. And then we can also talk about some of the different withdrawal strategies. We talked about just kind of the standard withdrawal rate, which is kind of inflation adjusted and kind of fixed, but there's several other kind of withdrawal rates that can be used, and each of them maybe kind of have different kind of goals and objectives to help. You know, some are to help kind of smooth income, some are meant to help you, you know, spend kind of as much of the portfolio as you can without kind of running out. Some of them are, we can talk a little bit more of those, but C Firestem has some choices and be able to do those, and I think that can also have a big impact on the likelihood of success.
Yeah, and I want to return to the number, the withdrawal number. Like, what is built into that exact figure? So we talked about the income side on the Social Security side. When you're talking about withdrawal from a portfolio, a part of the conversation too is like, okay, what's the composition? Do you have 50% in pre-retirement dollars, or do you have half of it in brokerage dollars? Is it all in brokerage dollars? Like, what would be the perfect, alignment there? And so let's just assume, I guess, just for the sake of argument, make it a little easier, that they're all retirement dollars. That's probably not realistic, but to maybe build in a higher tax cushion. So we know, like, again, let's say that some individual wants to pull out $50,000. Now that $50,000 is the need from an annual perspective, and that's net. So meaning it's not reflecting taxes. So that's after tax number that you're getting, $50,000. So you have to factor in, okay, well, what's the taxes going to be on there? And so if you look at the current tax rates in 2021, the time of this recording, if you're married filing jointly and you're trying to pull out $50,000 from a pre-tax account, that's just treating it as ordinary income. And, you're into the 22% bracket if you start to pull out more than $50,000, which is what we know we have to do in order to pay Uncle Sam his share and the state their share. So, just to be safe on there.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think, I'm glad you clarified that. I think, the amount that you withdraw can't necessarily be just your annual living expenses because, there are taxes, right? And so the taxes that you pay have to also come from something. You have to come up with that money, and that's probably needs to come from the portfolio withdrawal. So the amount that you withdraw has to pay for your taxes, and then what's left over is going to pay for your living expenses. I guess it really does depend a lot about what accounts you have your money and investments in, and obviously what age you're in. If you're at retirement age versus if you're not at retirement age, obviously that kind of the ease of accessing some of those accounts can differ. And I think we might talk about that in a later episode, kind of those mechanics of those accounts, but taxes is definitely something to consider. But I guess it really depends a lot, but I think I do feel like most people who have retired early or retiring early, like, the taxes are not as much as they would think, especially if you have a lot of you know, money in a, let's say, a Roth account or a just a brokerage, right? Because like just a normal brokerage account, you would be paying capital gains tax on that. And, you know, if you've held it for more than a year, it's long-term capital gains tax. And, you know, I think I don't quite remember the number, but I you can withdraw quite a lot of long-term capital gains and stay in the 0% kind of effective tax bracket, especially when you think of, when you factor in the standard deduction, right? So, you know, I think the standard deduction for a married filing jointly couple is like something like $24,000, right? So that kind of reduces your taxable income quite a bit to begin with. But so yeah, taxes is definitely something very important to think about.
Yeah. And just to give you the reference point, so 2021, if you're married filing jointly, you can have taxable income up to $80,800 before you start getting into the 15% tax bracket for long-term capital gains on the federal level. So
so that's quite a bit. I mean, $88,000 is what you said, and that's taxable income, right? So that means that's after the standard deduction. So that sounds like you can withdraw over $100,000 from a brokerage account, and as long as it's all long-term capital gains, your effective tax rate is 0%, right?
Yeah, well, so they'll add, you know, any income that you have, presuming in this situation you don't have any other income other than the whole pulling portfolio. Yeah. So let's layer in also the healthcare cost before we talk adding in. So like the total need, obviously factoring in taxes and also healthcare costs. So let's say you're retiring at age 40, and this is widely dependent on where you live. Certain states have subsidies. They provide those who are in certain income bands. And as far as I know, they're not doing any sort of means testing to say, okay, you've got, hey, $1 million in the bank, you know, you don't qualify for this subsidy to get health insurance through, whether it's the national marketplace or the state marketplace or what have you. So I just to give you an rough example to kind of play this, like 50,000. Okay, so if you needed 50,000, well, let's, I'm assuming you did not factor in healthcare costs for that $50,000. And using rough numbers, I would say $500, depending on if you're talking family, a couple.
$500 a month, I assume.
$500 a month.
So that's, yeah, that's $6,000 a year.
Yeah. So now you're up to $56,000.
Right.
And so you would incur that from basically, you know, for age 40 until 65 when Medicare kicks in. And so that's why you can see, kind of harkening back to our last episode, if you have a job, a part-time job that gives you some level of health insurance and also an income stream, that can really offset some of the need and the potential timing of when you can retire. So yeah, let's assume 56,000. Let's also assume maybe just a rough tax rate. So I said we're kind of into the 22 from a federal standpoint, if you're talking about ordinary income. But let's just say that, you know, it's not going to be all dollars. It's just going to be at the margins. So let's say that maybe 20%, and that's an all-in figure. Maybe you got, you know, your effective rate on the federal side is maybe closer to 13 or 15%. Maybe you've got some state tax as well. So maybe let's call it, just to make the numbers even easy and even there, 20%. And so if we do 56,000 divided by 0.8, which is, you know, the amount that we'll need pre-tax from these accounts effectively, that's $70,000. So suddenly that $50,000 jumped up $20,000 extra. And so this is often the case where I see folks, oh, I only need this amount. And then you kind of layer in these two very critical pieces and you're already at a much different number. So if we divide that 70,000 divided by the 0.04, that's a $1.75 million portfolio. So you went from the 50,000, which gets you 1.25. So that's an extra $500,000 required if you're using the 4% rule. Now, obviously, there's some other elements there, but I mean, wow, that could set you back a number of years if you're waiting for that figure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think health insurance is probably healthcare is probably the biggest issue for early retirees in terms of expenses. That's can be quite hard to deal with. And I think to the extent some states maybe have better sort of I guess, called healthcare marketplaces, where it's more affordable, right? And so I think obviously the state that you're in also affects your income tax as well. So I think it is something to consider if you're an early retiree and maybe you lived in a place because of the job market or the economy, and you're flexible and maybe you want to try something else. Like you could consider other states that have very low or zero income tax and or have robust kind of healthcare exchanges where you can get a reasonable rate, you know, because yeah, that's a huge factor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talking about kind of delaying retirement you could be delaying retirement, but if you use as an example, 0.05, so a 5% withdrawal rate instead, so that number ends up being 1.4, so $350,000 less if you have a higher withdrawal rate. The other thing that's not factored into this is, of course, that $500 a month is only going for, until age 65. And then presumably there's a different number that kicks in with Medicare if you're having a Medicare supplemental plan, Medicare Advantage plan. So that's in this assumption. So it's you can start to see as we start to layer in all of these different elements, much preferred to have rather than using a spreadsheet and have a calculator at your disposal, like the ones you mentioned. I'm curious, for those that are maybe familiar with using like Personal Capital or Wealthfront or Betterment or something like that, do you know if you could kind of model these into those tools?
Yeah, you can. I mean, I think they don't have as much. What's it called? Customization in terms of like adjusting your asset allocation, or I don't think they have as many choices for different types of withdrawal rates. But like, yeah, you can, you can, if you want to just model out kind of the retirement, you can just say, I'm going to retire at this age with this amount and I want to withdraw this amount. And then it'll tell you the likelihood of success for that. I think what they're really good at is helping you see the whole picture, which is, both kind of the accumulation as well as the spending. And so, if you're just focused on the kind of how much do I need to be able to retire, I think some of these other tools that are specifically about, that, like we mentioned already, FireCalc and FireSim are a little bit better there. But I guess, what is nice about the kind of Personal Capital type tools that you can add in these types of expenses that are not, persistent throughout the whole period, right? So I think you mentioned, maybe your healthcare expense is going to be high until you reach 67. You can do that at Personal Capital. You can say, I have an additional $6,000 expense for 25 years, and then it'll stop. And so it can help kind of model out those changes of income and expenses that most of these tools, I don't know if they support them or not. I think some of them do, or maybe there's some other ones out there that will do that as well. Certainly Personal Capital can use that to include Social Security, for instance. So I would say definitely, if you have expenses or income that you're pretty confident will change, and you can kind of model out what that change will be, like looking at something that can take that into account would really help you understand like how much those things will help or hurt your probability.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And just like something like earning extra income, so again, we were looking at that 1.7 that, if you're at $50,000 using 4%, that's $1.25 million required from a portfolio. Moving up to that $70,000, you're at $1.75 million. It sounds like a lot, of course. If you were to just earn $10,000 and reduce that $70,000 to $60,000, now again, this is assuming this is more back of the envelope and just assuming that that income is going to be earned throughout the year, until the end of time. But I think more realistically, what if you earn like $20,000 for a certain period of time, maybe half? So I'll measure that and add that into the output here. But earning $10,000 extra and reducing that $70,000 to $60,000 ends up bumping your need to 1.5 using 4%. So that's $250,000 that could be several years of savings that you didn't necessarily have to do because you're okay, given your skill set, that you might be able to earn at the very minimum, you know, again, $10,000 or $20,000, however you want to think about that. Even if you cut that in half, you know, in reflection that you're not going to be earning that $10,000 all the way through, that's still $125,000 that you don't have to save in these buckets, which again can be really big. I mean, this could be a number of years that you could shave off. You know, instead of it being 43, it could be, you know, 42, 41, 40, if you're starting really young, and so forth. So I think that relationship holds. But yeah, the key point is that obviously there's so many different elements. They start at different times. And so using technology and using these free resources out there can really help you understand the probability of success, which is such a key element, either using historical data or using what's known as Monte Carlo, which is just randomly varying the rate of return that folks receive in their portfolio every single year. So historical, just a quick aside on that one, historical is actually going to be more favorable because there's typically what's known as mean reversion, where in periods of really bad years, there's usually at some point a recovery and some good years. When you look at Monte Carlo, which is literally just a random number generator in right. most cases, it's going to be more harsh. And yeah. so you might see differing results. And that's, I think that's also an important consideration as well. So when you put all your data in these different tools, there may be different outputs, even if the inputs are the same.
Right.
It probably depends on what inputs they're kind of hiding behind the scenes and what inputs you have access to. And also what kind of system they're using from a historical or Monte Carlo lens. I'll think it's good to just use multiple and just kind of continue to build out your acumen and understanding of what a retirement need could look like.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely recommend people trying out multiple and just getting an idea of like, what is that range that different tools are kind of saying? And you know, obviously not just picking the one that's telling you the most favorable terms for you and saying that's it, because you know there's different assumptions that are being made. They have different methodologies that they're calculating things. You know, one thing we didn't touch on really is, well, maybe we touched on it a little bit, but I don't think we talked about why is, you know, for really to support a really long retirement, I think most people would recommend having a much more aggressive portfolio rather than that kind of traditional 60-40. You know, I think sometimes people recommend somewhere between 80-20 and then maybe even going up to 90-10 and then maybe even later being again 100% in equities. Can you talk about that a little bit? Like how that what do you recommend to your clients and I guess why a more aggressive portfolio might be required for a longer retirement period?
Yeah. And so maybe it's helpful to define the first, the more traditional route, which is, you know, the traditional methodology is typically you start with a 60-40. So 60% in stocks and 40% in bonds. And then as you get older, you start to get, again, in the traditional sense, more conservative. And so maybe you're adding in more and more fixed income. And so that 60-40 might drop to 50-50, 30-70, 20-80. And so typically I see for most of my colleagues and looking back in time, I don't know if I've seen too many 90-year-olds with all in bonds. You know, there might be a heavy majority, but at some point you kind of level out and you know, maybe is that 30%, is that 40%? I have seen, you know, 50-50. And so it stands to reason that you're older, you don't need to take on as much risk. But when you throw all these numbers into, you know, Monte Carlo or even the historical lens, and you increase the level of equities over time, that obviously increases a fair amount of risk, but the idea is that you're also compensated for that level of risk, and so you're still growing your portfolio over time. And so there's a very key portion of retirement that's very important to consider, the danger zone, so to speak. So it's that first really kind of 10 years or so of retirement. That is one of the most critical points of starting to draw down from the portfolio. And so there's this challenge called the sequence of return risk, where if you have a period of bad years and you start drawing on that, you know, and you have a fixed amount of expenses that you have to cover, and you start pulling from that portfolio, that can really derail the longevity of the portfolio. And so in this framework that we're talking about, it would be ideal to, instead of just immediately going to or keeping a 90-10 as this example, 90% stocks, 10% bonds, all the way through, maybe you dial it down a couple of years ahead of retirement. So maybe you're getting down to maybe that 60-40 is the example, very traditional. And maybe you carry that through for 10 years after you initially retire. And then you could consider to bump that up into maybe 5% every single year back up and dialing up the risk. And so that way it really helps the overall longevity of the portfolio. It's very counterintuitive to think, okay, I'm taking on more risk and kind of real paradigm shift in retirement. The older I get, I'm taking on, not progressively, it's not like we're saying go out to 100%, but still a meaningful amount higher than 60-40 and end up with higher probabilities of success than you would just kind of the traditional method.
Yeah, I think you can kind of think about that for a longer time period, right? Like if you have a very small withdrawal rate, you could imagine, but small enough, you may not need any stocks. You could just have it all in cash and you could withdraw that amount pretty much every year. Obviously inflation will hurt you, but as you want to have a higher withdrawal rate, or like a 4% rule, you really rely on the growth of that portfolio. And so, you really do need a much higher allocation of stocks. But like you said, there is that kind of period, right, when you first start retirement, that's kind of dangerous, and a really large decrease in your portfolio would really hurt, because even if there's large increases that follow it, it's like your portfolio is so small that it's hard for even large gains. It's still just a small base, so it's really never recovering. So there definitely are kind of methods to sort of try to mitigate that a little bit. I think you mentioned, starting out with a smaller allocation of stocks and then kind of gradually increasing it over time. I think, we didn't really talk about this as well, or we kind of maybe mentioned it briefly, but most tools and most, definitions of success is really just you don't run out of money, right? Like you pass away or you reach your end of retirement period and you were able to withdraw the money that you, plan to withdraw. That's success. But, I think it's important for people to think about what is their goal and what is success. And that doesn't have to be their definition of success. They can decide that actually I really want to leave a certain amount of money to charity. And you can, most of these tools also allow you to define like, success to me is having ending retirement, passing away with whatever, $500,000, so that I can leave it to my children or my heirs or a charity and stuff like that. And so, I think that's something to think about, because I think that also just that will change the numbers that go into it. And I think that's something it's if you look at some of these tools where they actually show you, not just the probability of success, but actually like all of the different kind of periods and how much money you would have ended up. Like so much of these tools are really, you're really trying to prevent the failure. But when it doesn't fail, like almost always the portfolio is like, ending with multiples of what you started with, right? Especially over a 30, 40, 50 year timeline. Like if you're not failing, you're often ending up with 2, 3, 4 times the starting amount that you started with. And so, that's, again, there are some other withdrawal methods that kind of, aim to capture that growth. And so you can actually spend it in a way that also makes sure that you don't end up with zero by kind of, instead of starting with a fixed amount that is just $40,000 inflation adjusted, you actually just withdraw a percentage of your portfolio every year. And that for when the portfolio does really well, you can withdraw more. But on the flip side, the portfolio doesn't do well any given year, you might have to withdraw less. So obviously some flexibility is required for something like that.
Yeah, let's get into that. I mean, dynamic withdrawal strategies. I mean, that what you're mentioning right there is, I think the guardrails approach. So that is one where there's three different rules. The first rule is no inflation adjustment if the previous return is zero or negative. The second is called the capital preservation rule. So usually this is before a certain age. If the withdrawal rate is higher than the greater, you know, let's call it 20% higher than the initial withdrawal rate, you reduce your spending by 10%. There's also another one called the prosperity rule, which is the flip side of things. So if the portfolio is done very well and the withdrawal rate is 20% lower than the initial withdrawal rate, you can increase spending by 10%. So it's a way for you to increase the dollars that you are getting. And if you have the flexibility in some of your budget, to you know, maybe that's discretionary spend, and you can increase it in the good years and decrease it in the bad years. That really, really aids in the longevity of the portfolio and increases the probability of success by a fair margin versus just your standard inflation adjustment. That inflation adjustment is very rigid in the portfolio modeling. I want to talk about a couple of others as well. So there's a floor and ceiling, which is just to say that, you know, you have flexibility to be maybe the floor is 15% less than this, you know, $70,000 or 20% higher than this. So you know, that also, by giving some flexibility rather than this kind of rigid inflation adjustment, also helps long-term longevity of the portfolio. There's also two, when you just think about it, they've done a lot of research on this. Now, this is kind of looking more traditionally at traditional retirement. So you're at 65, so you're a little older. You know, they've got what's called the retirement smile. So again, I would imagine this is very much the case with FIRE as well, where your spending could possibly increase out the gate. And so that's a little bit higher. And then over time, at least again, from a traditional standpoint, it starts to decrease. And maybe you get a little less active. And then maybe your healthcare costs start to increase. And then so that element starts to increase. And so that's kind of where maybe travel and leisure and stuff like that, that's mm-hmm. kind of half the smile. And then the other half has healthcare costs. I don't know. Who coined that? That doesn't seem necessarily as happy to have healthcare costs. But the other element too is just the concept of the go-go, the slow-go, and the no-go years. And it's kind of a similar concept where, again, spending will be higher out the gate and then kind of get a little lower. And then maybe you won't have as much mobility. This is likely, again, with FIRE, you still have a lot of the elements of traditional retirement as well. It's just expanded quite a bit. So you may still see that. And I guess the point here is that if you have flexibility, it can greatly, greatly impact your... So kind of returning back to the $1.7 million, I mean, if you had that flexibility, you know, you could have a much lower threshold and again, reach that milestone quicker if you're okay making that trade-off.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when it comes to talking about expenses and stuff, and something we didn't touch on is could be potentially something for people to think about is, you know, potentially educational expenses for their children. You know, I think that's something unique about retiring early is that oftentimes people are retiring before their children are in college, right? And obviously, college doesn't have to cost a lot of money. Your children may not choose to go to college, but, you know, if they do choose to go to a private university, like that can be very expensive. And so that is a type of expense that you will have to fund. You know, you don't have to, obviously your children can take out loans, but if you want to, as a parent, you want to fund that, like, and you are living off your portfolio, that will have to come out of your portfolio. So that's something to consider. Something that you mentioned earlier, I did kind of wanted to touch on, which is related to this, which is, when it comes to things like healthcare plans or subsidies or even things like college tuition, I think, you know, the most part, they really don't, the way that they kind of assess people's ability to pay is really not based on their assets or especially retirement accounts. Like anything in retirement account is almost never considered, right? Because they would never expect you to pull out money out of your retirement account to pay for, you know, college tuition and things like that. But even assets like in a brokerage account or maybe they're counted, but at a much lower kind of, are just not considered as highly as income. And so you know, being able to control your income and having being able to kind of demonstrate legally, like I have a low income, I only would, you know, withdraw $50,000 a year, you're actually able to get quite a few subsidies, even if you have, you know, $1 million, $2 million, $3 million in retirement or even some brokerage accounts. And so what that means is, you know, the cost of tuition may actually be quite a bit less for someone who's retired early with quite a bit of money in their kind of portfolio compared to someone who, you know, has a medium to high income who doesn't necessarily have a lot of savings at that point. So there are kind of a lot of advantages to retiring early in terms of funding some of those costs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great point. Great point. So there's a lot of kind of tricks along the way that can really aid this process. And obviously, there's a lot of complexity around all of the different pieces, expenses, length of time, withdrawal rates. One thing I wanted to ask you about is, what are some resources for folks who are just, again, maybe this last episode was the first one that they've really heard about this, and they're interested. This sounds very, you know, the why behind it makes so much sense. It's very motivating. And now we're talking about that, some of the how with regard, or sort of what is the dollar? What's the goal? Like from a mathematical standpoint, what are some levers that you can pull? But yeah, you know, how would people kind of learn more and kind of sink their teeth into it a little bit more?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll also ask you that question, I think, as well. I think I think we might have mentioned Mr. Money Mustache. I think it's sort of one of the early pioneers of, you know, financial independence, retire early. I think he does a great job of sort of painting the picture of why it might be something worth pursuing. What are the benefits? What are the flexibilities and kind of the philosophy behind it, as well as just, I think he also espouses a lot of kind of DIY attitude, which I really appreciate, which, you know, as someone who does have more time as an early retiree, you might have more, you know, might enjoy and have the ability to do things, more things yourself rather than hire other people to do things for you. But he doesn't necessarily talk a lot about like the math behind it or necessarily the mechanics of it. I think another resource that I like is, again, these are mostly blogs. So is a website called Go Curry Cracker. His wife and his child, they retired early, maybe 5 or 8, 6, 7 years ago. And he definitely talks a little bit more about the mechanics of things. He talks about how taxes are actually calculated. And he's an example of, like, you know, I think he, you know, they live on like $80,000-$100,000 and they pay almost no tax. And it's not tricks and it's not fraud. It's like, it's, you know, if long-term capital gains, it kind of paints a picture of how that math works. So that can be a good resource. What else? And then if you really want to get into the kind of the nitty gritty and the about withdrawal rates and you like numbers and you want to really just kind of analyze that, Early Retirement Now is a really good resource. It's run by someone I think is he's a really very technical background, some sort of scientist or
data. Yeah, he's sort of for NASA or something.
Yeah, and so incredibly really detailed stuff, and he has some tools on his website that allow you to get very very specific and to kind of model a lot of different scenarios. And so definitely a great option if you're really interested on that side. But I'm curious to hear what other resources are you aware of, and if, you know, people ask you what are some resources, what do you tell them?
Yeah, I think another podcast, Choose FI, is a good one. The podcast really, I think, dedicated to financial independence. Yeah. and how to make that happen. All sorts of, I mean, they've been doing it for a number of years. I think that this person is a little less active that you mentioned, but I liked looking at the Mad Fientist, Mad Fientist, and that was a good one. I think there's a blog as well as a podcast there. Yeah, a lot of this is more. I mean, so a lot of the traditional research has been focused on traditional withdrawals and traditional retirement. So you're not going to find. I think. This movement has come into more of the mainstream, and I think there is more folks that are from a professional lens taking a good look at some of the things that. But that being said, you know, obviously the folks that we've talked about are more kind of maybe not coming from that expert lens, but the research that they do, and they kind of put especially early retirement now, I mean, kind of running through a lot of the math behind it. I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb here and probably stands, you know, close to, if not better than some of the other research that's out there on an expert side. So, yeah, it depends on how far down you want to go in this rabbit hole, but it's good to at least, just kind of hear different ways, and kind of understand and join this kind of community. Cause it can be challenging. And I think next time we'll talk a little bit more about the accumulation and like, where do you start to put the money in these different buckets, the mechanics and sort of that, part of things. So staying kind of connected and in tune with the goal, because this is, I mean, unless you come into a significant amount of money and you're just able to, you know, there's some sort of windfall, whether it's like your company went public or maybe there's a large inheritance or something like that. This likely takes a number of years and requires, you know, discipline and there's staying connected to that. From a worst case standpoint, you know, even if you quote unquote fail, like you still are putting money and saving money aside, you know, putting it aside, and you're doing yourself a favor and giving yourself optionality. Even if maybe, you know, a couple years down the road, it's like, that's just not, you want to revise and your goals change. Mm-hmm. You know, you're still doing something very positive for your financial situation. And maybe you need to back down a little bit and make it a little bit more sustainable than maybe kind of a crash diet. So yeah, I think that's all good stuff. Any last kind of comments or points around the different elements that we spoke of today?
Let's see. I think, yeah, we talked to kind of a lot about the different variables and things that could impact your withdrawal rates and some of the factors that you might consider. And I think it can feel overwhelming. And like you said, I think, you know, it takes time to kind of figure it out, and you don't have to go it alone, right? There are financial planners out there. Maybe not all of them have that same experience or expertise with regards to kind of early retirement. So I think if you were to go seek a financial planner out, like, talk to them, ask them about questions about that, because I do think some of the things are unique, and general concepts apply, but I think some of the elements are unique, and so it's helpful to find them. But try not to get overwhelmed. I think, you know, we talked a little bit about the 4% rule and some of the maybe challenges with it, but it's not way off, right? And so I think if that just helps you kind of set your sight on a goal, and it helps you and motivates you to save more and to make progress towards a goal, you can refine and get more detailed with that goal kind of over time and stuff. You don't have to do it all up front.
Well said. Very well said. So different components there, you know, maybe adjust those a little bit for taxes, even if you're just kind of a rough tax figure out the gate, and maybe healthcare as well. And then using that 4% rule, I think, is a good kind of, again, back of the envelope to get your sights geared and kind of do a quick gut check to see, okay, well, how long potentially could it take to get to that number, which we'll talk about in our next episode. So, yeah, stay tuned. Thanks everybody for your time. Let us know your thoughts. If you're interested in pursuing financial independence, if you're maybe a little bit further along your journey, or maybe you're already in FI. So let us know. I'm really curious your thoughts. Feel free to send us any feedback that you have, which is feedback@maxfinancepodcast.com. And yeah, thanks everybody for tuning in. We'll see you next time. We're a new podcast, and it would mean the world to us if you took a moment to write a review in the Apple Podcasts app or share this episode with a friend or family member. We'd like to hear from you. Is there a topic you're interested in? Have feedback more generally? Email us at feedback@maxfinancepodcast.com. Thanks, and see you next time.